Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Oh, yes, we did. Started to burn many things we found. This is Earth Day today, April 22nd, 2014. Beautiful day here in Columbus, Ohio. I hope it's beautiful with you where you are. It's an honor to be on again at the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. Thanks so much to our wonderful crew in New York at the PRN studios. We're going to have a really solid Earth Day program today. We have with us the great Michael Marriott. Michael has been with this movement for God knows how long. I'll ask him in a second. He is on the line. But we are celebrating Earth Day today. Earth Day began in 1970. It's great how it caught on, actually. Earth Day is now a part of our calendars. It's part of our national ethic. And like Martin Luther King Day, it's become a piece of the fabric of our country. Started back in 1970 with Gaylord Nelson, then a senator from Wisconsin, and so many others. And I hate to admit it, but I remember the first Earth Day 44 years ago. Michael Marriott, you're with us.
Well, happy Earth Day, Harvey.
Michael, thanks. Same to you. Happy, happy Earth Day. Thank goodness we have an Earth Day to celebrate. Thank goodness we still have an Earth to celebrate, although we are barely hanging on. And you are one of the reasons we've been hanging on. Michael Marriott has been the executive director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service since the beginning of time.
Now
has turned over the reins to someone we had on our show a week ago. Tim, what's Tim's last name, Michael?
Tim Judson.
Judson. I remember that, and he did a great job. But you are the man who have been with us from Nuclear Information Resource Service since what year? What year did you take over the reins?
1985.
So you're just shy of 30 years at the NIRS, Nuclear Information Resource Service, which has been one of the pillars of the movement against nuclear power. And we are going to talk about this delightful, wonderful, long overdue, but finally pretty well, I think, established in the Parthenon of mainstream debate, let's put it that way, the transition that we are making, the solartopian transition that our society is making to renewable energy, to solar, wind, tidal, geothermal, ocean thermal, wave, increased efficiency, mass conservation, all that stuff. I'm gonna be able to talk that like a rapper pretty soon.
Yeah.
But I wanted to start with you, Michael, today. We'll talk about NIRS in a minute and all the work you've done over the past 30-some years. But I want to talk about a major victory that I know you have been deeply involved in, and that is the cancellation of these two reactors that were planned for Temelin in the Czech Republic. Can you tell us about this great victory for the forces of life on this earth?
Well, sure. Temelin is a site. There's two reactors operating there now that we tried to stop. We had a large international protest in 1997 I was at. And then the utility there decided they wanted to build two more. And these were going to be Westinghouse reactors. But they told the government, the utility CEZ, told the government that they would only build them, could only build them, with really massive government subsidies. I mean, basically what they wanted was price supports. In other words, forcing the ratepayers of the Czech Republic to pay, absolutely exorbitant rates once these things were built. and additional subsidies to get them built. And to their credit,
Michael?
Yeah,
we're getting some kind of dial tone. I'm sure it'll go away. Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. And to their credit, the Czech government elected not too long ago said, no, you can build the plants, but there's no subsidies. We're not going that direction. And, of course, that was it. The utility said, forget it. We're not doing it without subsidies. And it's the same thing you see worldwide. There are no nuclear reactors anywhere being built without some type of subsidy.
And tell us how this victory was won in Czechoslovakia. I mean, this has been a long, long fight. You've been on it for decades. How did this finally come around?
You're trying to stop the first two was a long fight. I mean, this was a site originally in the old Soviet days. They were trying to build some Soviet-designed reactors there. They got them partially finished. The Soviet Union collapsed. The Czech Republic decided they didn't want the Soviet reactors. So they got some Westinghouse to bring in some Westinghouse parts and sort of create these hybrid reactors. That's what's the two that are operating there now. And there was a lot of protest, and that set back, you know, the plans to build the extra ones for, you know, at least a decade, a little more. And the, you know, the opposition has continued, and the opposition is successful enough that the government didn't feel that, it could force subsidies, those kind of charges on the people of the Czech Republic. You know, the opposition wasn't going to let them do it.
Right. So they make a really, really bad pun. They refused to give the reactor builders a blank check.
Exactly.
And we have something of a democracy in the Czech Republic. Is that right?
Yeah.
I guess this proves it.
It's a democracy. It's worth noting that the previous government was urging the utility on. They were totally behind Temelin. But like I said, there was an election there, I don't remember exactly when it was, but about a year ago or so, the new government came in and, you know, they took a different position. Their position was do what you want, but don't ask the ratepayers to pay for it and don't ask the taxpayers to pay for it.
How much money was involved in these two reactors that have been canceled now?
How much money were they going to cost?
Yeah.
I don't think anybody knows. It's not all that transparent there. It was going to be in the, you know, many billions of dollars. These were going to be Westinghouse AP1000 reactors, similar to those that are being built here in Georgia and South Carolina. And those have price tags in the, you know, $7 to $8 billion each. So that'll give you a basic idea.
And how important is this to the nuclear industry in Europe that these two reactors have been shut down?
Well, you've got a situation in Europe where, despite the nuclear industry's best efforts, there really isn't much new construction going on. You've got one reactor in Finland, which is now 5 years behind schedule and billions and billions of dollars over budget. You've got another reactor being built in France, which will probably be the last reactor ever built in France. The government there says they want to reduce their reliance on nuclear power from its current 78% down to at least 50% over the next decade. And you've got a couple other projects in Eastern Europe that are, you know, basically on life support. So there's, you know, it's the same situation everywhere. Unless somebody, meaning taxpayers or ratepayers, are subsidizing these things in advance, nobody is willing to build a nuclear reactor. Nobody's willing to put up their own money.
But the British now, this conservative country government in Great Britain, seems to be pushing nukes in a whole other way. What can you say about that?
They are. Although, again, this is on the drawing board stage. They have a plan to to build two new reactors. These would be Areva reactors, and they would do it in partnership with Électricité de France. These would cost, I think the estimate for both of them is up around $22-24 billion. And again, the only way that Électricité de France agreed to be part of this is if the British government provides massive subsidies in terms of price supports. In other words, the British ratepayers, assuming these plants are ever built, which is not necessarily a safe assumption, I'll get to that in a moment, but the British ratepayers would, electric rates would rise, I think it's around 50% just for these two reactors. Now, the European Commission, the European Union, has a policy against government support for large power plant projects, period. Not only nuclear, but all kind. The European Union believes that the utilities should have to pay for them themselves, that government stepping in and offering these large subsidies is an unfair competitive advantage given to corporations. So it looks like, well, they haven't made a final decision yet. What happens there is that an agency of the European Commission reviews projects like this, and in the initial review that they've done is that this project is untenable, couldn't happen without these subsidies, and that the subsidies are outrageous and in violation of European Union rules. Now, if they come back with that as their final decision, and this is something, you know, takes some time, that's going to kill the project. The British government has plans, and there's a couple other reactors that they are even further, that they're pursuing, but even further away than this project is. But their plans may come to naught because, again, because of the subsidy issue.
And my understanding is that the construction of the reactors that the Cameron Conservative government in Britain is proposing would drive electric rates in Britain just really, really high.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the price would actually be above the cost of offshore wind, which is, certainly the most expensive form of renewables right now, until the technology becomes more established. And it would be even above that cost, and much higher than the cost of, any other renewables. So,
what is going on? What is going on in their mind there in the Conservative government? What's driving? It's patently insane what they're talking about.
That's a question I can't answer, but I do know there's a lot of opposition to these reactors in the UK. Interestingly, Scotland is having a vote soon on independence from the UK, and Scotland has become a very anti-nuclear country, and they want to go on record against these plants. Which they can't do as long as they're a part of the UK. But assuming they vote for independence, and I don't know which way that vote will go, but if they do, they said that they're going to go in in formal opposition to these plants.
I wonder if they can take legal action against them once they're an independent country. That'd be interesting.
I think that's all done through this European Commission process, and there's been a lot of comments submitted. All the environmental groups in the UK are participating, as are groups on the continent, because it's a European-wide process. So it gets a lot of attention and a lot of participation.
So that's interesting. Scotland is willing to become a separate country again from the UK.
The issue is not only over these plants, but that is one factor that they said one thing that they've said they're going to do if they do become independent.
That's interesting. I teach U.S. history. The last time the Scots were making these kinds of noises was during the Glorious Revolution in 1688.
Yeah.
So
there
you go. And I cannot resist throwing in a bit of trivia here. When Scotland resisted England, King James II wanted to make Scotland a Catholic country, wanted to make all of England revert it back to Catholicism after all the years of being the Church of England. And the people who came down out of the hills in Scotland to support King William of Orange were known as hillbillies. That's the origin of the term. We have to start the Hillbilly Alliance to oppose these reactors. We're talking with Michael Marriott. Michael is the longtime executive director, now the emeritus executive director of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, one of my best buddies. I'll never forget, Michael, I had known you a short period of time. I thought you were a real straight arrow, actually. And then when I was initiated into Greenpeace to be senior advisor, the executive director of Greenpeace took me to a very famous, now in retrospect, concert that the Grateful Dead gave at the football stadium in Washington, D.C., and it was pouring down rain. And I walked into you, and you were totally soaked and had this huge Grateful Dead smile on your face. I'll never forget that. That was back in 1990 when we were both still young and crazy.
Still are, but, you know, you got to remember, I was a punk rocker for more than a decade before then, so, you know.
And you have your own band. Do you still have your band?
We played last week, in fact.
Okay, and you're a drummer, right?
That's right.
Oh, fantastic.
Michael Marriott, we put out a new EP last week, and we played, and we're playing again in a few weeks in Baltimore, in case any of your listeners are headed to the Sowebo Festival in Baltimore. We'll be there.
What is the festival?
Sowebo Festival.
Spell that for me.
Sowebo.
What's that stand for?
Southwest Baltimore.
Oh, cool. So you and what's your band called?
True Facts and the Insaniacs.
God, we should play a cut from you guys. You got any CDs out there?
Right, we do, yeah.
All right. Oh, man.
I think there might be some songs on iTunes. There's probably some on our website, truefacts.com. But
what is
getting
the name
off
of your group again?
Probably.
What's the name of your group?
True Facts and the Insaniacs. T-R-U-F-A-X. T-R-U-F-A-X.
Uh-huh.
And the Insaniacs.
Oh, my God. All right. I'm gonna Skype into the crew there. Now, of course, they corrected me.
We've actually never recorded our anti-nuclear songs, but we do have some.
Your favorite cut, if we can play a cut here?
Washingtron is probably the biggest hit.
Washingtron?
Yep.
Okay, I'm going to ask I'm going to Skype into the crew in New York to see if we can come up with a cut there. You're of all the people in the anti-nuke movement in the U.S., I think you know the most about what's going on in Europe. And you're particularly a veteran the Ukraine, or now without the Ukraine. Can you tell us, given the turmoil in Ukraine now, what is going on with Chernobyl? Do we have any cause for increased concern about what's happening at Chernobyl based on the instability in Ukraine?
Well, I think there's always some cause for concern about Chernobyl, but not necessarily because of what's happening in Ukraine, but, you know, the fact that there's still an awful lot of molten fuel at the bottom of that reactor, not to mention the threat of forest fires in the region. The one time I went to Chernobyl, there was a forest fire in the region, and our Geiger counters went up pretty dramatically when that happened, and they do every time there is one. If you get a large one, it's going to send radiation all over Europe again. But they're continuing to make some progress. They finished, they've been building this replacement for their sarcophagus that they threw up, fairly hurriedly after the accident, to try to cover up the core and the reactor. They finished recently, just a couple weeks ago, a major piece of that, and they're actually going to wheel it over the existing sarcophagus any day now, and then the second piece to it, though it's going to be two pieces, is going to be fairly quickly behind, and that's an international effort, mostly being paid for by the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. So things are, Chernobyl's pretty far away from any of the conflict points in Ukraine right now. One thing that we reported in our blog, Green World, that seems to have been missed by most people is that when the Russians came into Crimea, they took over, they seized a nuclear reactor in Crimea. It's a small one. It's a research reactor. Ukraine actually had a national nuclear university in Crimea, where they trained people, trained the workers for all their different reactors. And the Russians came in and seized that place. And, of course, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency, that's a Ukrainian reactor, not a Russian reactor. So we don't know how that's going to play out.
Did the Ukrainians build their own reactors as opposed to the Russians?
This is just a research reactor. It's small. It's not a commercial size reactor. The Ukrainians have been building some reactors for many years now. They've never finished them. And it's not clear that they ever will. The reactors that are in the country now, they're all old Soviet reactors.
If Ukraine splits apart and it becomes the ethnic Russian area goes to Russia, which side is Chernobyl likely to come down on?
Chernobyl would be in western Ukraine, the European side. Chernobyl is just about due north of Kiev. It's up near the Belarusian border, definitely part of western Ukraine. The part of eastern Ukraine that we're talking about here is, in terms of land mass, not that large, but there are some large industrial cities in it. And of course, I have a lot, we have an office in Ukraine, NIRS WISE International Network. Since I'm married to Ukrainian, I have a lot of contacts in Ukraine, and there's clearly not much support even in eastern Ukraine for actually becoming part of Russia. But it isn't so clear, what's going to happen.
No, it's not. We're talking with Michael Marriott. What's your new title at NIRS?
I'm president now.
President of the Nuclear Information Resource Service as opposed to executive director. NIRS started way back when in the 70s,
1978. Was founded by a guy named Stanley Weiss, who I've actually never met, who went around the country and asked activists. You'll remember back then it was a very decentralized, very local movement centered around reactors that were, for the most part, under construction. And he asked these different groups what they needed, and they said, we need some sort of networking office in Washington. We need a Washington office. We don't want to get taken over by a Washington group, but we need a Washington office to network and keep us informed. And so that's what he founded, and that's still at the core of our mission is to keep all the local groups out there, and there's hundreds of them, keeping them informed and letting them know when there's actions or things they can do that will make a difference, letting them helping them understand what agencies like the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the Department of Energy are doing, what Congress is doing up to, and affecting, policy however we can.
Well, you've done a great job over the decades, and we're going to continue with you. Anything you want to say about the situation in Europe before we take our break in about 5 minutes and then jump into what's happening in the U.S.? I know that people tend to lose track of the European industry, and which is in a rapid decline, thankfully, the nuclear power industry over there. I did want to... George Monbiot, who has been writing, or Monbiot, however you pronounce it, has been writing for decades about, a long time, about global warming and came out in favor of nuclear. But then he wrote an article in The Guardian, really freaked out about the proceedings of the construction of the reactor and the idea that they were going to build more reactors in England based on the cost. I wonder if you've seen any reaction from the global warming supporters of nuclear power in England about the price tag that's coming down on this new proposal.
Well, I think, as is true everywhere, most of the environmental movement in the UK is staunchly anti-nuclear. And staunchly pro-renewables, and I think you see that reflected in, publications like The Ecologist, but even, somewhat more mainstream publications like The Guardian. Monbiot's sort of a weird case because he seems to have come to a seems to be one of the very few people who looked at Fukushima and decided that made him pro-nuclear rather than anti-nuclear.
I think he must have taken a drug before he went over there. I mean, I read his stuff. It's astonishingly ill-informed.
And part of it was based apparently on a series of emails he had with Dr. Helen Caldicott where... she didn't answer his questions the way he wanted to, and he suddenly jumped to the conclusion that everything he had previously thought about nuclear power was wrong. And he just made this, tremendous leap, I'd call it a leap off a cliff, without really looking further into it to see if, Helen says this, what are these other people saying? And so it's always been sort of a puzzling thing to me. I don't know him, so I don't have any particularly original perspective to offer. But it just seemed to me to be sort of a rash decision or a rash position to take on his part that probably he'll come to regret.
Yeah, I he's a thoughtful guy, and I couldn't help but be somewhat amused by the article he wrote when he realized how much money they were talking about for new reactors there. I mean, it was like he'd got sticker shock, and I can't imagine how he's reacting now when it becomes even more clear what an insane amount of money they're talking about for new reactors in England. It's a horrible deal.
Right, and of course that's nothing compared to the actual sticker shock that
will occur, right.
If they ever build the things, because as we know, nuclear construction projects tend to go over budget, tend to go way over budget. I mean, here in the U.S., from our original fleet of reactors, the ones that were built mostly back in the 70s and 80s, the average cost overrun was over 200%. So that's nearly actually three times the cost that was originally projected. And some of them went, 8 to 10 times over their original cost.
Right. So, and see, Shoreham went seven times over and then never opened.
Right. So if you're going to start off with a cost, north of $20 billion, and you're looking at 200% above that, that's a pretty startling figure to contemplate.
It is indeed. We've been talking with Michael Marriott, one of the true heroes of the Earth Day reality, decades of very effective campaigning against nuclear power. He's been the executive director of the Nuclear Information Resource Service. We're going to break here for a minute. Michael, while we're on the break, I'm going to search the web for an MP3 of your song, Washingtron. If you can email it to me, I will email it into the studio in New York, and we'll give it a run. We're here at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show, and the next half hour we're going to focus on one of the great experts, Michael Marriott, on what's happening with nuclear power in the United States. In the meantime, let's take it away with the Rocky Top version of the Solartopia song from my good buddy Dana Lyons.
Coal plants, new plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams, Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan, oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Sweet home to me, Solartopia, that's the future for me, green powered energy, windmills, hydrogen, photovoltaic cells with solar panels everywhere, solar cars, fast trains, bicycles, hydroplanes, get you home in under an hour.
Dana Lyons. Yeah. All right, that was Dana Lyons singing the Solartopia Rocky Top version. Go look at Cows with Guns. Up to 2 million hits for Dana Lyons, my good buddy, a wonderful singer. His last album, or CD, I think, was called Three-Legged Coyote, which I love dearly, and he's got a song on there about breaking up with his girlfriend, and it's called I Really Miss Your Dog. I love that song, one of my favorites. We're with another musician, a punk rocker, and also one of the great leaders of the anti-nuclear movement all these decades, Michael Marriott from the Nuclear Information Resource Service. Michael, give us your websites, your URLs, if you would.
We have the main organization website is www.nirs.org. And earlier this year, when I stepped down as executive director and became president, it freed me up to start a new blog, which I'm editing, called Green World, and that's at www.safeenergy.org.
What do you put on this blog? What people go to this blog, what are they going to see?
Well, what we're trying to do with it, first of all, we're posting just about daily, 4 or 5 times a week, and we're really trying to chronicle what we see as the transition to a solartopia, if you will, to a nuclear-free, carbon-free energy system, which is a transition that we believe is still in its early days, but is nonetheless happening, is accelerating, and is going to be here earlier than just about anybody had thought possible.
Tell us about that. Give us some detail on that.
Yeah, so we're talking about, and I should do one qualifier here, is that of course, as we've all learned in the decades fighting nuclear power and in other social justice movements, nothing happens unless you fight for it. So this is not something that is going to happen if everybody sits back and does nothing. We're trying to point out, you know, where the nuclear and fossil fuel industries are trying to prevent this transition from happening as well. So that's the main purpose of the blog. And, you know, we're pretty proud of the kinds of things that we've put up. But, you know, I think it's perhaps best exemplified by several posts that we've done in the last couple months, where we've gone through reports from the Rocky Mountain Institute, but also major institutional banks like Goldman Sachs and Citigroup and some of the smaller investment banks. And just in the past 3 months, they have all come out with reports with startlingly similar conclusions, which is that rooftop solar power, the price is falling so fast, and battery storage is advancing so quickly, and I want to talk a little bit more about that in a minute, that by within 5 years, in California and some other states, Hawaii is already there, by the way, it will be just as cheap for a homeowner to have a solar system on their house and be off the grid than it will be to stay on the grid. Now, that doesn't mean that the homeowners have to leave the grid. In some cases, you know, they can sell power back to the utilities, but it means that the price has gotten to the point where it is rooftop solar power is competitive with any other source, and there's a domino effect here too, because I mentioned, you know, Hawaii is already there, California 2018. Right behind California is New York State, you know, not exactly sunny paradise. And a whole Texas comes in right after California. And by around 2030 or so, the entire country falls within that price fixture, where it's just as cheap to put solar up on your house than it is to, you know, get power from your electric utility. And that is causing enormous changes, will be causing enormous changes in the entire electric utility industry. Electrical demand is already going down. It peaked around 2006, went down because of the Great Recession, but interestingly, it hasn't recovered. And one of the reasons why is that energy efficiency programs in a lot of states are working and driving down demand. And the other is that things like rooftop solar are happening, and that doesn't show up for utilities as increased electricity production. It shows up for utilities as decreased electrical demand. So this is a trend that's going to be accelerating. In fact, is accelerating. Right now, a new solar rooftop system is being installed in the U.S. every 4 minutes. By the end of next year, that's going to be every 90 seconds. And meanwhile, you've got Elon Musk, who's the head of Tesla Motors, the electric car company. He's got really big visions, and they go way beyond Tesla. He's now searching for a site to build what he calls a gigafactory that is going to do nothing but produce batteries. And these batteries are, of course, going to go into Tesla cars, but it's going to be capable of building far more batteries than Tesla cars can handle. They're going to be used for solar rooftop installations, and it's worth noting that his cousin is head of SolarCity, one of the major rooftop solar companies.
And who is his cousin? What's his name?
I'm sorry, I don't remember his name off the top of my head. But
okay, well, Michael Marriott, you mentioned, and we're going to go on with this, this truly solartopian visioning. But you mentioned resistance from the fossil fuel and nuclear power industries. Tell us why the renewables are so fearsome to the fossil and nuclear industries, and what the fossil nuclear industry is doing to resist renewables.
Well, there's two factors going on here. One is the long-term factor, which is that the utilities can see that this the era of building large power plants of any kind is ending and will end over the next 20 years or so. And the new era is going to be, you know, much smaller distributed generation, which involves everything from rooftop solar to wind farms. But, you know, sort of like the local food movement has caught on, you're going to be getting your electricity locally sourced, too, and probably from your rooftop, as will the business down the street. Right now it's, you know, mostly bigger outlets like IKEA and Walmart, those kinds of things, kinds of places are putting up solar on their rooftops because it just makes so much sense. But in the not-too-distant future, it's going to be much smaller businesses, too, as well as you and your neighbors. We're not there yet, but we're getting there, and we're getting there quicker than anybody imagined. But on the short-term situation, and here's where you sort of have the dinosaur wagging the tail effect, last year there were four operating reactors that were shut down permanently, and there's a fifth, Vermont Yankee, that already announced it's going to be closing later this year. And there are a number of others, at least a dozen, that are in similar situations to Vermont Yankee, to Kewaunee, which closed, to everybody's surprise. These are reactors that are closing, not for safety reasons, but because they cannot compete with A, natural gas, and B, renewables. Particularly in the Midwest, where you've got Exelon, which is the nation's largest nuclear operator, they're having problems competing with the large amounts of wind power that are being put up in the Midwest. In the Northeast, Entergy has a lot of reactors. They're having problems competing with gas, but also with, believe it or not, solar in the Northeast and wind and energy efficiency programs.
Well, we have had Michael Marriott. We're talking with Michael Marriott, the president of the Nuclear Information Resource Service. Michael, we have had strong rumblings from Exelon that they were going to close a bunch of their reactors, and now we're having some kind of workshop in Washington, maybe you know about it, where they're going to have a discussion, and it's obviously geared to be a pro-nuclear discussion about all the shutdown of these reactors and the alleged effect on climate change. And the industry has just signed up Carol Browner, who used to be I guess she was head of the EPA under Clinton, is that right? And now she's thrown in her whatever with the nuclear industry and is out there advocating. I mean, it's interesting dynamic that here, not so long ago, they were jumping up and down trying to get new reactors, you know, built, and now they're desperately trying to keep old reactors operating.
Right. Well, that's exactly right. It's this new group called Nuclear Matters. We've looked into them some. It appears to have been founded by a PR firm, Sloan Public Relations. Their only utility or nuclear client is Exelon, so we think we can trace it back pretty clearly to them. And you're right, they just signed up Carol Browner this week. They originally had two former senators, Evan Bayh, a Democrat of Indiana, and Judd Gregg, a Republican from New Hampshire. They also got former Obama White House Chief of Staff Bill Daley on board, who's always been close to Exelon. Spencer Abraham, who was a DOE secretary under George, one of the Bushes. And this group is not devoted to promoting new nuclear power. It's entirely to try to prevent more reactor shutdowns. And what they want is, and we wrote about this extensively on Green World, what they want is to rig the deregulated electricity markets, because what's happening is power from alternative sources is coming in cheaper than power from these aging, expensive nuclear reactors. They can't compete with it anymore, and that makes these reactors too expensive to run, even though they're paid for. In addition, some of these reactors, they haven't collected enough money for decommissioning yet, and these utilities are looking at potentially getting stuck with decommissioning bills that they haven't fully funded yet, so they want to run them as long as they can. And so they're trying to figure out some way to rig the market so that ratepayers have to pay more for nuclear power and have to use that nuclear power rather than renewables and in some parts of the country, natural gas, simply because it's nuclear power. And of course, yeah, they've tried out these arguments like it's reliable baseload power. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, this whole concept of these, you know, big behemoth power plants of any kind that we used to call baseload power, that's sort of a 20th century construct. It doesn't work in a 21st century grid. And, you know, they don't know exactly how they're going to do this because, ironically, these are the utilities that wanted deregulation in the first place.
Well, as we'll recall, of course, when it came time, the big push for deregulation around 1990 was done essentially to pay off the debt on reactors like Diablo Canyon, San Onofre, the two in Ohio. I mean, the utility industry, the nuclear utilities walked away with billions and billions of dollars in what they called stranded costs. One thing you can say about the nuclear industry is they have no shame and lots of imagination.
Yeah.
And, you know, when it came time to deregulate, they, with a straight face, went in and said, well, we want a free market in electricity, but first you have to pay us for our nuclear plants because there'll be unfair competition. I mean, come on. They got away with it, of course. And now they're going back to the opposite direction and they're saying, well, you've paid for our nuclear plants. They're amortized, and we don't have capital costs anymore, but now we can't compete. So you need to subsidize us so that we can continue generating nuclear waste and irradiating you and your children and running the risk of another Fukushima. That's the whole line here.
And that's exactly what they're saying. And it's exactly what this group Nuclear Matters is about. And they are actively, I mean, very actively, you know, and you can see this by the number of, you know, op-eds that are placed in newspapers around the country, you know, by, you know, various front people for the industry and for this group. You know, they're very actively working with policymakers in the back rooms, you know, trying to figure out ways to do this. Now, you know, one of their problems, of course, is it's hard to rig a completely deregulated marketplace. if it's deregulated, you know, how do you do it? So they have to, you know, to be able to do it, they have to put in some regulations, and which is, of course, counter to the whole concept, and it isn't that easy to do. But they're looking at ways to do it. They're looking at ways at the state level. Certainly in Illinois, Exelon is, you know, really pushing this, where the bulk of Exelon's reactors are. And in all the New England states, they're, you know, they're working at FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is an agency that's not very well known, especially by activists, but it's going to have to become better known.
Well, it's got a great acronym, FERC. I mean, how can you argue with an organization called FERC? But Michael, Marriott, we only got 8 minutes left. Shocking how the time flies when we have a great, articulate guest like you. We're honored with Michael Marriott. He's been, for decades, the Executive Director of the Nuclear Information Resource Service, now President and the Editor of the Green Wire, which is on the web. We've been unable to find your song to play, Michael, but next time I have you on, we'll play your punk rock song. We only got 5 minutes left, actually, I'm told. And what we're looking at here, let's look at the big picture really quickly. After all these decades of fighting uphill to promote renewables, I feel, and especially with this IPCC report, the Intergovernmental Policy Commission on climate change, that what has resoundingly endorsed renewables. I mean, I sense a momentum shift. Maybe you do too. That really people have now, the marketplace, such as it is, has so powerfully endorsed solar. I feel a very, very different kind of atmosphere in the industry. Do you?
Absolutely. I mean, the utilities are scrambling. Arguments that nuclear power is actually counterproductive to addressing climate change, especially if we want to do this quickly, and we do, are taking hold. And as you said, the simple economics of renewables, they're there now. You know, back when we had Earth Day in 1970, the renewables weren't ready yet. They were too expensive. They were too inefficient. 40 years later, that's no longer the case. They are ready now, and we're going to be seeing more and more of them. A report, in fact, came out yesterday, and there was a survey done of planned new electrical capacity in the U.S., and for the first time ever, a majority of planned new capacity in the U.S. is renewable.
That's amazing. Now, do you have a piece on – have you posted that piece?
I haven't yet. I'll probably get to it tomorrow.
Okay, and give us the URL for your website for both NIRS and Greenwire.
NIRS is pretty simple. It's NIRS.org, NIRS.org, and Greenwire is even simpler, safeenergy.org.
Okay, we've been talking with Michael Marriott. We're down to the last 3 minutes here, and we're celebrating the change to renewables that's happening all over the world, except, and there's a big fight now, of all places, ironically, in Japan. How we wound up with a fascist government in Japan in the wake of Fukushima is one of the great tragedies. And I will have to say this, that, you know, as the radiation is now arriving on the west coast of California, and I have a grandchild in L.A., so it really bothers the hell out of me, the one good thing that has come out of Fukushima is that the 48 reactors that were left have remained shut, and they are conceding that at least 30 and maybe more will never reopen. What do you think about that, Michael, on our way out here?
I think that's right. I mean, most of them cannot meet the new safety standards they've set up, which are, you know, probably more similar to existing safety standards in the U.S. than they were before. Most of them can't meet those standards or couldn't meet them without your extensive, very expensive work, which they're not going to do. I'd be surprised if they ever get more than a handful up, because, you know, this government's not going to stay in power forever. And, you know, the reason the anti-nuclear movement in Japan, which is, you know, a clear majority of the population, hasn't won at the electoral level yet is because they've split their vote every election. Once they realize that that is a losing proposition, as they should have learned by now, that can change.
And so, okay. Well, we're looking forward to a solarized post-Fukushima Japan, a solarized post Three Mile Island United States, a solarized post Chernobyl Europe. Michael, it's been an honor and a pleasure to have you on. Michael Marriott, the president now of the Nuclear Information Resource Service and the editor of Green Wire. It's GREENWIRE. Is that right, Michael?
Green World.
Green World, GREENWORLD,
right.
Online. And your punk rock band, again, is called?
True Facts and the Insaniacs.
Next time I have you on, we're going to play one of your cuts, at least one of your cuts.
I'll find one and email one to you
Please do. I was remiss. I should have done it before the show. This has been another wonderful Solar Tub. Time just flies by with a guest like Michael Marriott. Thank you so much, Michael. Thank you to the wonderful crew in New York City, to PRN. We're going forward. We hope you're coming with us. This has been Harvey Wasserman, another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show on Earth Day 2014. Be back with you next week. In the meantime, no nukes, and we will see you in Solartopia.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.